I'd like now to welcome Kristen St. Clair. She's Executive Director of the Humankind Foundation. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So what's the Humankind Foundation all about?
The Humankind Foundation is a foundation that I started over 10 years ago now, based on education. The focus is education. And it ended up being in East Africa. Originally, it was an umbrella organization that was going to be in other places in the world. But my focus has become so much there that that's really where I'm working. So it's about empowering girls. It's about educating in villages. And it's about sustainable results and cultural sensitivity in the villages.
So you're working principally in Kenya?
I'm working in northern Tanzania.
How did you end up there?
Well, I'm working with the Maasai, and it's only because the colonials came and divided their land into Kenya and Tanzania. But essentially, they go from all down the Rift Valley, from upper part of Kenya, clear into Tanzania. The reason I ended up there was that I was on holiday with my daughter, and I went to visit a friend that's got a ranch on the west side of Kilimanjaro, and ended up traveling throughout Tanzania, and it became where I stayed.
You were just drawn to the place?
I was completely drawn to the place. I always was growing up.
So you have a school there?
Yes.
For whom is the school designed?
The school is, I'm actually partnering with Aung Sarian, and they have a school called Nuncodon, which is a school for Maasai boys and girls. There are over 100 kids in the school. And it's unique in that it gives the Maasai children a chance to be educated. It's a high school, but also to understand more about their culture. So whenever possible, all the classes are given with the idea of the Maasai culture being integrated into the studies. And the part that I'm the most involved with is a safe house. And that's connected to part of my foundation called Kamilika, from the Swahili verb kamili, which means to be whole, perfect, and intact. And the safe house is for girls who have left their villages because they don't want to be circumcised and have early marriage and stop their education. So somehow they find their way to my school, and they're able to be schooled there in the safe house.
Now, we have been talking on this program for many years about female genital mutilation, and it seems like there has been a real movement, and not just from the outside, not just from Americans and Europeans, but from within Africa, to put an end to this practice. How is that going?
It's going really well, and you're absolutely right. There are many, many movements within Africa, from West Africa, all across sub-Saharan Africa, into Kenya and Tanzania, to stop FGM, or female genital mutilation. It's going really well. When I first started this work, 10 or 15 years ago, people didn't know about it. Now it's really rare that I talk to someone that hasn't heard of it, or doesn't say, oh, someone just talked about it, or I just heard about it on the news or something. So there's a lot of awareness about it. Clearly, a lot of the places I work are very deep in the bush and don't have news and don't have ways of reaching them. So the way that we reach them is through teaching and training trainers in their villages who go in deeper into the villages. But it's going really well. It's actually, there's a lot to be done, because there are 130,000 girls at risk every year and approximately 6,000 cut every day. But
every day?
Every day.
Good heavens.
Yeah. 98% of the Maasai girls traditionally have been cut.
And is that still the case?
I would say that the numbers are dropping. Nobody's really looked at them to know, but I would say the numbers are definitely dropping. I think the thing to really understand here is that Africa is like a basket, and you pull a piece of it and all of it unravels. So you can't just address the issue of FGM and say, well, these girls are no longer being cut, because what happens to the circumcisers? You have to consider them as well. And the circumcisers are paid in goats, and they're the older women, and they're generally perform their ceremonies, and the goats will sustain them by having more goats and milk and until the next circumcision ceremony, and they'll go from village to village to do this. So once they're educated and they accept putting down their tools, you need to figure out a way that they can still live. And then there's the question of the bride price. The fathers, Maasai are focused on their cattle. That is it for them. And there's 140 names for cattle. And so the men really want the girls to be married because that's the way that they increase their herd and get more cattle. So if the girls aren't cut and they're not married, the father doesn't get the cattle. So we develop alternate rites of passage so that the girls can still go through the marriage ceremony. They can still have all the secret, sacred information, but they're not cut, and the father gets the cattle. So all those things have to be considered.
Right. What do you mean by the secret, sacred information?
What happens during the rite of passage is that the grandmothers and the female elders of the tribe will initiate the Maasai girl into the next age set or the next stage of their life. And until a girl has gone through the rite of passage, she really isn't considered a woman. She isn't considered a person. She has a different name. People don't speak freely in front of her. So growing up, there's a huge desire to go through that so that you can be accepted as a woman. That's what they Maasai kids have a really wonderful time. They play and then they play grown up, and they want to be brides and they want to have babies, and the little boys put on all these really cute braids and do all these things to be warriors. So they want to go through that, to have their grown-up name. But they can't have that until they've been through the rite of passage and they've received this information. So some of the information is Maasai cultural stories and things that hold the mythologies and the Maasai traditions. And then some of it is just health information. So what we do is we educate those women so that when they go through the rite of passage, they impart new information, such as about HIV/AIDS, such as the increase of sugar and what it does to yeast infections, how to identify health issues, urinary infections, all those kinds of things, a money management piece. Those are the things that we're using now in the rite of passage so that the grandmothers still feel that they're imparting very valuable information that nobody else knows, but it changes the girl's life in a different way.
Why did they cut their genitals off in the first place? What's that all about?
Well, I don't think it was thought up by a woman. I'm sure that it was thought up by a man. The first recorded instance is 143 BC, when the women came from Ethiopia as slaves to Egypt, and they arrived cut. And the Greeks also made mention of it in BC. I think originally it was to change a woman from community property into chattel. The idea being that you're mine and I own you, and if you don't have sexual pleasure, you won't need to stray. And then what happens is that once you develop something like that, you have to develop mythologies to keep that in place. So in West Africa, for example, there are certain beliefs that have been handed down from generation to generation that if you give birth and you're not cut, your grandparents will die. Well, who's going to be the first girl that's going to put that to the test?
Right.
So, and that's really believed. And a lot of times they will say, it's in the Quran. We don't exactly know why you have to do it, but it's always been done. It's in the Quran. So there's a lovely movie called Mulade, where one of the women in a West African village gets a little pink radio, and she hears, it's not in the Quran. And the men can't read and write either, so they have no way to refute that. So the woman has this piece of information that mushrooms in the village. So it's not, I don't mean to say that it's Muslims, certainly, because it's Muslims, it's Christians, it's educated people. I have a friend who's a doctor in Khartoum, and he took his girls to the hospital to be infibrillated, which is the worst kind of circumcision, and had it done to them in the hospital. So they were anesthetized, but their lives were no less horrific from then on out.
We're talking to Kristen St. Clair about the Humankind Foundation. So, I mean, what you said before is very interesting. This metaphor of the basket, if you pull one strand, the whole thing starts to unravel. Okay, so let's say you are able to have a generation of girls who have not been cut, have not had their genitals mutilated or cut off or whatever. then you have a generation of women who do experience sexual pleasure in a way that their mothers and grandmothers and everybody else didn't. That also changes society.
Mm-hmm. It does. And it changes in a way that if when the girls graduate from my school, many of them don't pass the A levels or the O levels. We're on the British system. And they're very difficult. The Tanzanian exams are, I probably couldn't pass them because they're not sensible. You know, they don't involve logical thinking. You just learn by rote. So when I talk to the girls and they say, what am I going to do? You know, I feel like a failure. I may not pass the A levels. I say, well, you're bringing back to your village incredible information. You're going to be a wise woman. You'll go back there. You'll get married. You won't be cut. And you'll have children who won't be cut. You're going to change the ideas in the village because you can be a married woman. You can have respect and dignity and not be cut. What happens now is that in Tanzania, the school fees are pretty extreme for a lot of the people who are very, very poor. And the girls really want school fees. So a lot of them will leave the villages and they'll go into the towns and they'll perform sexual favors for money for school fees. Well, what that does is corroborate the fact that these girls aren't cut, so they are sexually wanton and they can't control themselves, and look what happens to them. When in fact, if you gave them school fees, they probably wouldn't have to do any of that. They just really want to go to school.
Right.
So but the idea is that if they're not cut, they're going to go to the village, and this is what's going to happen. So the more that we see the girls going back to the villages, which they're doing now when they graduate from my school, and from other, you know, other places where they can be not cut, is that they're able to be married and lead normal lives. And this has never been seen before.
Now, how did their husbands respond?
The husbands have never really had an issue with it. They just want the cows. So as long as they get the cows and the bride is married, they're fine. And I've talked to so many of the fathers. And when you explain to them what's involved with female genital mutilation and how it's different than what the men go through, they're shocked. They just say, because they never see it. You know, it's a completely different ceremony that's in a very, very different place. They never see it. They're not part of it. When you explain it to them, much less even show them what it's about, they just say, oh, not my daughter. No, I don't want that to happen. I didn't realize that that's what was going on. So they're actually much easier to educate than the older women and the grandmothers.
What is the older women and the grandmothers' stake in keeping things the way they are?
Fear. Tradition. Not understanding what the differences mean. Not understanding, because when you go through your entire life without a clitoris, it becomes a bigger thing than you can imagine in your brain. You know, you don't know what the difference is. And often when we sit and we talk by the fire into the night, the women who are my friends now in the villages, they will ask me, you know, well, how do you sleep? I say, well, what do you mean? Well, I mean, aren't you just constantly wanting sex all night? And I say, no, I sleep like a baby. And I try to explain to them what it's like living, you know, when you're not cut.
Right.
And that's huge for them. And there's a doctor in New Zealand who's done a study on the clitoris and what it looks like and the differences between what it was thought to be and what it actually is, and how it's open like a bat's wing throughout the whole lower pelvis. And I show them pictures of that and say, well, this part is gone, but your whole lower pelvis has got nerves. And they're fascinated by that. They don't know a lot about anatomy, and to understand how that works is empowering for them.
Another thing that happens to girls who get cut and then they become women, they have children, is it does create a lot of problems in childbirth.
A myriad of problems for their entire lives. It predisposes them to chronic urinary infections. It predisposes them to difficulties with their menstrual flow, and not to mention infant mortality rates that go up substantially because darker skin keloids, and you end up with large ropey keloids that you can't get through to get the baby out. And certainly in the bush they can't, because they don't stretch. So there's a lot of infant mortality that comes as a result also. And that's actually a good point, because that's the question, that's the, where I get the men. I'll say they want more children. It's really important for them, because they want the boys to take care of the cattle and the girls for to help the moms. And when I say your children may die as a result of this, that catches their attention.
Right, right. Now, I mean, all over the world, all over Africa, life is changing. Traditional village life isn't what it used to be. What are some of those changes that you're seeing, and how do they affect the kind of larger social picture among the Maasai?
There are certainly a lot of changes, and there are a lot of changes within indigenous people all over the world. And I see, when I'm at the United Nations in New York at the tribal conferences, there, you know, all of the tribes get together, and I find that that the problems are fairly common no matter where you live. I mean, you can be a Sami in the northern part of Scandinavia, or you can be in New Guinea, and the women will all talk about the redundancy of the men and how the men are no longer needed to hunt wild boar or to kill lions or to hunt with the reindeer and whatever they're doing there. And that's certainly the same with the Maasai. And you know, people see the Maasai in their full dress holding cell phones. It's a very, very difficult line to walk. And certainly the elders are more invested in keeping the Maasai culture, but most of the Maasai are too, and they need a way to be able to live in both worlds. And that's a lot what my school is doing, because we're able to educate them, but in ways of the Maasai culture. So even though they're going to high school, they're still going home for ceremonies. They're still learning things that way. Now, that said, you know, they're going to be going off to college. And most of the time when they get educated, they will go back to the villages and they will help in the villages. They don't go back to the village and say, well, I've been sleeping on a feather duvet and I just don't want to sleep on these beds anymore. You don't see that. You really see them going back, and you really see wanting to be part of the village and part of the change. But the change is inevitable, both in good ways and bad ways, I think.
What are some of the good and bad ways?
Some of the good ways are that they are getting education. You know, it's been a double-edged sword. The autonomy and the Maasai autonomy is not only because they're nomadic and because they can be deep in the bush, but there's also a lack of willingness to assimilate. You know, in Tanzania, we had a prime minister, a president called Julius Nyerere. We call Mwalimu teacher because he was an incredible man, and he united all the different tribes. I think there were 141, through commonality of language, through Swahili, and it helped enormously with tribal conflict. But the Maasai don't really want to learn Swahili. They want to speak Ma. And so, very much like the Basque, they remain completely autonomous within, you know, the civilization all around them. So the double-edged sword is that their autonomy keeps the traditions more intact, but it also prevents them from having access to health care for things like HIV/AIDS and for you know, education about female genital mutilation. And people will often say to me, well, you know, what, it's not my business, and what am I doing interfering, because it is their cultural tradition. And certainly it is, but when you see a girl who is cut and bleeds to death, and those who don't bleed to death go through their entire lives with these problems, it's not going to happen on my watch. That becomes a human rights violation.
Well, and also there are just so many African men and women who are against it. It's not like you're bringing in this foreign idea.
No, no. I work within the villages, and the women that I work with are the creating choirs now to go from village to village to teach the other villages about how that works. And it's not just the stopping of the FGM, it's also HIV/AIDS awareness. And I have to really say that it's a lot, the diet is changing enormously. And I've seen that before, you know, in populations I've worked with. You see babies now being fed in their mother's arms, you know, Fanta, orange soda pop in spoons. And then the babies get yeast infections, and they think they need to be circumcised because of this yeast infection. So there's lots and lots of health issues that need to be addressed. It's not just the FGM, and we address them all comprehensively. What I want to do now is I want to start a community center north of the school so that on Saturdays the girls can rotate through there and start empowering themselves by becoming community educators and working with a nurse up there so that they can, if they don't pass their A-levels, they will go home to the village and they will be sort of little mini nurses, and they'll have a level of understanding of what's going on health-wise that they can be the wise woman in the village.
Now that's your training also. You're a nurse.
I am. I'm an RN, yes.
And so you're able to teach a lot of skills to these young women.
Sure. And I can write curriculum, and I do. Mm-hmm.
We're talking to Kristen St. Clair, Executive Director of the Humankind Foundation. Now, you were talking a moment ago about these choirs that are going from village to village and singing about how you shouldn't cut your daughters and AIDS education, things like that.
Yeah, that was such an exciting moment when I found out. Somebody actually called me, and I was in Europe at the time, and they called and told me that was happening, because that is the sign of true in-depth change. That is really when you know that this has been absorbed into the community and in a way that has been believed. Because it's a non-written language, that's the only way that they communicate, and it's through stories, and they love to sing, love to sing and dance. And so to have these stories be part of the new songs and the new dances means that it will go on and on forever. And that was just absolutely enormous, because my goal had been, rather than to educate in a buckshot way, to take one area, in my case in Manduli, and to work saturating the villages, village by village, so that you get a 100th monkey thing, which became the choirs.
Right. And so basically, women just made these songs and dances up and started performing them.
Absolutely.
So you've got troubadours.
Yeah.
You've got Tanzanian Maasai troubadours.
Exactly. And I have them on tape singing these songs. Yeah. The Mama Kiki songs.
Maybe we could hear one of these songs at the end of the show today?
Absolutely.
Oh, good.
Yes. I'd love to play one.
Okay. Well, so we'll stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen, for that. You have an amazing story and are working on a film about a young woman who escaped, and it's this incredible story of her sort of, I want to say, mythic journey, escaping from her village so that she wouldn't be cut and married off to somebody that she didn't want to be married to. Tell us about her.
It is a mythic story. It's the story of a girl called Teresia, and she lived in her father's village really deep in the bush. I mean, a lot more deeply in the bush than my Maasai friends had been. And when I would mention her village, they kept saying, oh my gosh, it's really far away. And I thought, well, how far can this be? Well, I found out it was really far. So one night when she was 12, her mother said to her, you're going to be cut and you're going to be married tomorrow morning to an old man as his fourth wife. And she was the oldest of five little children, younger than her, I think it was five. And she said, I know that you love school and I know that you want to keep studying. And she said, you are our hope. You are the hope for your brothers and sisters and for the women of our village. So when it gets dark, you must run away. And she said, I have nothing to give you. I have no food. I have no shoes. I have no clothing. I have nothing to give you at all, but I have a gift that I've been saving for you for the last 2 or 3 years, and it is this, that people on black roads know about schools, and you must run until you find a black road. And they had never seen a black road.
Being so, just basically an asphalt road.
A tarmac, yeah. So that night when it got dark, she ran off into the bush, and she really didn't know where she was going, but she just kept following this moon, and she said she would keep the moon and the sun on different sides of her, and she kept going. She slept in acacia trees. She was chased by lions. She said the elephants were the worst. Sometimes she'd be in a tree for 2 days, and they wouldn't move, and she couldn't get down, and she'd sleep in holes because of the hyenas. I mean, this is, you know, it's like Dorothy and the Wizard, you know, going through all of these horrible things, and she came across an old Maasai woman, and the Maasai woman had food, and she said, oh, thank gosh, you know, grandmother, can you please share with me? And told her what she was doing, and the grandmother said, absolutely not. And she turned her back on her and said, you're a disgrace to our town. You're a disgrace to the Maasai. go home and be caught. I'm not going to help you.
Oh, my goodness.
And she turned around and ran away. And Teresia, I mean, she must have been bedraggled. And at one point she fell out of a tree and hurt her leg, which we found out later had a stress fracture. And she kept going and going. It took her 5 weeks.
What did she eat?
She ate bark. She said she ate tree bark mostly and sometimes leaves.
Oh, my goodness. And so then what happened?
Well, she finally, I think it was 5 weeks, and she came across a woman, and she kept saying, "Have you seen a black road?" And the woman said, yes, she had seen a black road. It was just over there, over a couple of hills, and pointed. And, you know, it's nothing for a Maasai to walk 10 or 15 kilometers, but this was a long journey. So she pointed, and Teresia took off, and sure enough, she came to a black road, which was one of the tributaries going into Arusha in northern Tanzania. And there were some cars, and there were donkey carts, and people selling charcoal on the side of the road. And, I mean, she must have felt like she was on Mars. You know, it was so much chaos and people and noise. And she was ill, and she hadn't eaten, and she had dysentery. And so, and plus, she was Maasai. And the other tribes don't particularly like the Maasai, and she didn't speak Swahili. So they looked at her like a pariah and didn't help her either. And finally somebody said, the woman who sells charcoal a couple of kilometers down the road is married to a Maasai. Go talk to him because he speaks your language. So she went down there, and he happened to know the headmistress, or knew someone who knew the headmistress at Nuncodon School, and said, yes, you need to get to Mama Kiki's school. But it wasn't like he could jump in the car and drive her there. He just said, it's that way. And so off she went again for 2 days.
Presumably they gave her some food.
Yes, they did feed her. But still, off she went, and she got to the school, and I have her on tape.
And you're Mama Kiki.
I'm Mama Kiki, yeah.
And so you met this bedraggled 12-year-old who'd been walking for, how long had she been walking?
5 weeks.
5 weeks. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, you got out a video camera and taped her immediately.
I did.
How did you know to do that?
I just thought that this was I think she and her mother are the bravest people I've ever met. I was so overwhelmed by her bravery, and I was so overwhelmed by the fact that she had gone through this to go to school. That's all she was trying to do, was go to school, to get a different life for herself and her mother and her brothers and sisters and the other women in the village. I was so incredibly moved. I said to her at the time, Teresia, your story will be heard, and I will make sure that it is. Absolutely. And it will be. And I found out later that her mother, who made the ultimate sacrifice in turning her daughter out into the wild, she didn't know for a year and a half if Teresia was alive or dead.
Right.
Because we couldn't go back to the village. The father would have killed us because the cows had been paid and it caused huge trouble. The mother was beaten within an inch of her life and sent back to her mother's village. And so all of that had happened. She didn't know about Teresia. Teresia had left at 12 years old. The life she knew, which was entirely different than, even though she was with Maasai girls, some of them were city girls, some of them were village girls. The food was different. You know, she's in a dormitory. It was an entirely different experience. She missed her mother so much, and she looked like, you know, a tsunami hurricane victim with that face of just shock and numbness, you know, where they say the parasympathetic and the sympathetic systems are not integrated. You can't function. You know, you try to get somebody to a Red Cross tent, but they're zombies, you know, and that's how she looked. And so I got someone up there to talk to her. And she graduated from the school last year.
So she's 17, 18 now?
She is. And I went back to her village 2 years ago. And it was that far in the bush. And met her mother, May, and did an interview with her mother about what it was like to send her daughter into the wilds, not knowing if she'd ever see her again.
Now, you're making a documentary about this young woman.
I am. Yes, I am. I really want her story to be heard. I want kids in America to see it. This is a true story about what people go through to get to school.
Right, and all these kids who are in middle school right now who don't want to go to school.
Exactly, and I say that to the girls. I mean, I say, you know, school's free in America. That's the first thing, and it's free in a lot of Western countries. And they don't believe me. They say, oh, come on, Mama Kiki, that's not true. And I say, no, honestly, it is. And I say, as hard as you work, you know, to get to school. And her story is certainly, you know, epic, but it's not the only hardship story of girls that have gotten to my school. And I say, as hard as you work to get here, that's how hard in America people work not to go to school. Rubbing thermometers on the blankets, you know, all the things that you do not to go to school. And they don't believe me. I mean, as many years and years and years as I've been telling them, they just think it's completely nonsense. So one of the girls who's in the school, Frida, we're working now to bring her over here. She was always my shining, curious star, and she wants to be a doctor so that she can go back to the village and teach the other people in the village. So we're working now also to bring Frida over here.
And so she would go to school, go to high school, or I mean college and medical school here in the United States?
Yes,
is that the idea?
Yes. She would go to, I'm working with Anna Tupler down at Santa Fe Community College, and she would go there first and then hopefully to UNM or somewhere else if they give her a scholarship, wherever she can go to medical school.
We're talking to Kristen St. Clair of the Humankind Foundation. So how has this story, I mean, Teresia's story, affected, if it has, her own village? I mean, this disaster happened, her mother was beaten up and sent away, but this girl escaped. Has there been any kind of effect of that?
Well, I think her mother has started her own village of women, which is fairly unprecedented. And so there are six huts in the village. There was one being made when I was there. And it's Teresia's mother and her aunts and cousins and all women that are in the village. They're enormously proud of Teresia. They want her sister to go as well. And Teresia didn't do as well on the A-levels. It's very hard for the Maasai in school because they don't have the same schooling when they're young that a lot of the other tribes have that are closer to villages and closer to cities. And they're also having to leave a lot to take care of cattle, or a drought happens, or there's ceremonies or that sort of thing. They don't have electricity, so they can't study at night. There's nobody really to reinforce the studying for them. And they really live in the present moment. A lot of, even though the Tanzanian school system is based on a memory system rather than logical thinking, there's still enough sequential thinking that it makes it difficult for them, because they really live in the present moment. So when you say this and this and this happens because subsequently such and such will happen, that's not a concept that's a concept that has to be taught and learned.
Is their language all in the present tense?
Yes.
And so you can't say...
And you don't mention anything about death or anybody who isn't there anymore. So that once they're gone, they're gone. So if you show somebody a photograph and you say, well, here's a picture, you know, a photo of that I took of your mom, and you may want to have it because the grandchildren may want to see it. They'll say, oh no, I mean, when she's gone, she's gone. We don't need to have any pictures. There's no idea of genealogy or that happening.
And so that would deeply affect somebody's, for example, science education, where mm-hmm. if you're only living in the present tense, you'd have a harder time studying chemical reactions and how when you mix these mm-hmm. things, this will happen and then this will follow from that.
Right.
I mean, all the things that we talk about in modeling climate change are all about having a sense of past, present, and future.
Exactly. And in the very most basic way, that isn't the way that it works in the Maasai villages and in the Maasai world. So for a Maasai to go to school, there's a whole mindset that needs to be completely changed. And what they have to do is really put one foot in both camps. Because when they go home, there's a whole other different way of looking at the world.
Right.
Which is cattle-based. And then school is a different, whole nother... You know, we have the same way of looking at the world, even though our lives are compartmentalized. So, you know, you go to church on Sunday and you have dinner with your family Sunday night and you hang out with your friends Monday night and you have your work friends and everything's compartmentalized. But there in the village, it's all the same. Nothing is separate. So your spiritual life and your food and your shelter and your home and your friends are all part of the same thought process, the same age set, rituals, everything is the same.
When people learn, for example, to think sequentially, and then they go back to their village life and go back to their culture and ceremonies, does it detract from their ways of life? Does it add? What happens?
I think that in some ways it can add. I think the person who goes back, and I've seen this happen many times, the person who goes back The people in the Maasai village know their place. So if somebody goes back and an elder says that's not the way it happens, the person who's been away to boarding school understands that. And because it's an elder, they would never talk back anyway. Maasai kids are really well disciplined. And there is a certain person, you know, like the in the Pueblos, what's that? With the switches, you know, the person that comes around. There's that person in the Maasai culture too. So if you're bad and he catches you, you know, he'll switch you. So the kids are really, they're very well disciplined, and there's a hierarchy of who you respect. So when you come back into the village, nobody is braggartly or saying that doesn't make sense or we're going to do it a different way. There's generally such a respect for the culture and for their place in the culture that it might be suggested. And if it's accepted, fine. And if it isn't, fine. It goes both ways. And that person usually has a place in both worlds. They either choose to go back to the village, and then they can change some things, or be the intermediary between village life and the town, so that they can go in to get medicines or talk to vets or whatever they need to do to go back and forth. So some of them choose that role. Some choose to live in the towns and become guards. A lot of Maasai are askari, the guards that we use around the houses in town. So in that case, they go back to the village and they straddle two worlds.
You talk about the cattle-based life of Maasai people. Do they face problems like we have here in New Mexico, for example, of overgrazing and drought and all the things that ranch-based life is about?
Absolutely. Everything in their life is based on the cattle. Absolutely everything. So when there is suicide among the Maasai, it's not very common, but it does happen during droughts, and it will happen when the cattle die. There have been a lot of droughts in East Africa lately, and it kind of similar cycles to what we're going through here in New Mexico. We'll have 7 years of a drought or 10 years of a drought, and the rain will be bad, and there is then no grazing. Because they're monsoons, we have short rains and long rains. So if you have the long rains, that's the grass that really replenishes the cattle. Then you have a dry period, but you know the short rains are coming. If you have drought, the cattle will die, and because they are nomadic, they've always taken the cattle wherever they've needed to go to find that, which has become, of course, more difficult because people are buying land and there's reserves, and you can't go here and you can't go there. So the cattle are more restricted in where they can go. And how that affects the girls is that if there is a drought and a lot of the cattle have died, then the father wants to marry the girl when she's younger, because that means that he'll replenish his herd. And what happens is that it's against the law in Kenya and Tanzania, which it works really as a detriment, because they aren't going to stop cutting if they're going to. They're just going to do it deeper in the bush. So if she hemorrhages, they won't seek help. And of course, the laws are written in Swahili, which they don't speak, which is completely a moot point.
Oh, my goodness. Now, are there any backup systems evolving economically? I mean, if you have a totally cattle-based life and then there are all these challenges to raising cattle, are there any other things that are coming up to take
that
place?
Well, I mean, that would make sense to our way of thinking that, you know. But no, because there are lots of other tribes that live in northern Tanzania. The Chaga, you know, do coffee growing and, you know, are very successful with that. But the Maasai believe that the other tribes that are agrarian are beneath them. And for them to start doing that is humiliating and beneath their purpose which is to take care of the cattle. And they believe that God, Enkai, gave them all the cattle in the world. And they pray to Enkai every day. And so they have Laibon, who are the men that take care of the medicine and the spiritual aspects and the problems and things, but the God gave them all the cattle. So when they would see, you know, a white farmer with a bunch of cows, they would raid that and get the cows back. They couldn't understand why they were put in jail, because they were just doing what made sense. They were their cattle. This man had made the mistake. He took Maasai cattle, which clearly belonged to Maasai. So they need to increase their herd. So if there is a drought and the cattle die, which has been the case a lot lately, they'll circumcise the girls younger, putting them at much greater risk and do it further in the bush so that nobody will see them, to get cattle to replenish the herd.
We're talking to Kristen St. Clair with the Humankind Foundation. Now, how did you really get into this work? I mean, you were a nurse, you were working in refugee camps, you went to Africa.
I went to Africa on safari with my daughter to visit friends and ended up staying there. And at one point, my daughter said to me, "Mom, I feel as though you're speaking to me from a different place inside yourself I've never heard before." And it was very clear to her at that point that I would be back. And I had heard about Africa a lot growing up in Europe.
And it was the first time you'd been there.
It was the first time I had been there, but my family had a history there. But I was asked to do a medical evaluation for an NGO that was based in California, and I was in Musoma on Lake Victoria in a very poor part of Africa. And I went into a little hut to evaluate the women who were the caregivers for this NGO that was based on orphans, HIV/AIDS orphans, sending them to school. And the woman showed me her book very proudly that she'd gotten from the government saying that she had tuberculosis. And I looked at it and I thought, gosh, I mean, she's sleeping on the floor with 8 or 10 kids in this little hut. And tuberculosis is an airborne disease that's transmissible through coughing on other people. So I wrote her a prescription and for some medicine for 6 months and also for a chest x-ray. And I went back a couple of days later to check up on her. And she had taken my prescriptions and put them up on the wall and made little frames around them and had her uvula cut out. And I realized...
She had her uvula cut out?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Because that was supposed to be the cure for TB. The Maasai have their lower front tooth taken out to prevent tuberculosis. So you see a lot of the Maasai with this bottom tooth gone that they pull out when they're children.
Yeah.
But apparently she wasn't Maasai. She was Luau, I think. And that was what they did for TB. But I realized in that moment that she hadn't understood a word that I'd said to her. That you can't talk virology to someone who doesn't know basic heart-lung bypass, who doesn't even know that they have lungs, how they function. And it was one of those non-linear moments when of transference of information, when in that nanosecond I realized, this is why I'm on the planet. I can do this. To educate a woman is to educate a nation. And this woman is thirsty for knowledge. She wants to know. So I began teaching using basic kindergarten coloring books and those models, those plastic models where you open them up and take all the organs out, you know. I used those and I went to Arusha. And from that moment on, Mary Charlotte, it was as though I couldn't not do it. You know, everywhere I went, I met somebody who said, "Oh, I work for Farm Access for President Clinton. Why don't you come and work for us and do this and do that?" And I met a Maasai nurse called Joanne Kowisiyanga, who had been doing HIV/AIDS education in around her village in Arusha. And we started educating together. And we were a perfect team because I could manage the NGO world and the grant writing, and she could manage the villages and what to do and how to identify who in the village. So we worked really well together, and we started it by educating the men. And we made them the ones that went into the village and started teaching. It wasn't until later we educated the women, and we had incredible success. And to this day, that whole area is still really saturated with information.
And their rate of disease and infection and all those things have gone down as a result.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it still is down.
Now, there's a concert coming up this Sunday, the 5th of May at 4 in the afternoon at the Lensic, an unusual time to have a concert. And Dave Brubeck's son, Darius Brubeck, is going to be playing. And it's a benefit for your foundation, the Humankind Foundation.
It is. It's going to be a really wonderful, magical event. Dave Brubeck died in December of last year, a day before his 90th birthday. And his son, Darius, has been a friend of mine since high school, almost 50 years ago in Connecticut. And we feel as though we've kind of come full circle 50 years later on the stage here at the Lensic, because in the interim, he moved to South Africa and married a South African woman and started the first degree jazz program at the Durban University, where he taught for many years. So he is going to be performing a lot of his South African jazz, as well as his father's classics.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, as we were talking about before we went on the air, a lot of music aficionados know him not as Dave Brubeck's son, but as this guy who does this amazing South African jazz.
He is definitely a musician and composer in his own right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And Darius Brubeck will be joined by Morris Studi, who
Morris Studi, who'll be doing vocals. I'm really excited about that.
We're going to have them both on the air later this week, too.
Oh, good, good. Yeah, yeah. And John Trentacosta and Straight Up will be performing also. So they're all going to be performing individually and then together with Darius.
Now, the film that you were making that we were talking about earlier is being done in collaboration with Santa Fe Community College and Jean Medeiros, who is one of our wonderful filmmakers here in Santa Fe.
Yes, and I'm really excited about that. He's terrific and a great storyteller. He's going to be going over there to help develop the script and do the script for me. And it's going to be a wonderful collaboration. I'm really glad that I found him.
Do we know more or less when that film might be done? Or
we're going over in September and October, and we're going to work on the film development then. And then once we get that, then we get the money, and then we make the film. So
maybe in a year or two, we'll see.
I would say a year, hopefully in a year.
You got to come back on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to.
So Kristen St. Clair is executive director of the Humankind Foundation, which is on the web at humankindfoundation.org. And we're going to go out with a little bit of music right now. And this is music from one of these choirs that is going around Tanzania, village to village, and singing about AIDS and FGM education.
Absolutely. Yes, it's beautiful. Well, and I wish you could see the women when they sing it, because they're in their full regalia with all of their beads and all of their necklaces and the big wide collars.
Right.
And the collars are going up and down and up and down as they move and sing these songs.
Oh, boy. And that presumably will be in the movie, too.
Yes.
Well, Kristen St. Clair, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure.
Ramayana, Baba Ramayana, 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 Ram